All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here this evening. We're going to continue through church history. We're going to get to the Crusades and some details there. But I want to set something up for you. First of all, I've got these verses talking about genealogies in the Bible. Paul writing to Timothy in Ephesus, 1 Timothy 3, he says, I urge you when I was going to Macedonia, remain in Ephesus so that you may charge certain persons not to teach any different doctrine, nor to devote themselves to myths and endless genealogies. There's a warning. Also, he writes, we're going to get here in a couple weeks, to Titus, this saying is trustworthy, and I want you to insist on these things so that those who have believed in God may be careful to devote themselves to good works. These things are excellent and profitable for people, but avoid foolish controversies, genealogies, dissensions, quarrels about the law, for they are unprofitable and worthless. So there's something to be said about genealogies that are dangerous, a waste of time. But yet we have in the Bible a list of genealogies. Starting right here in 1 Chronicles 1, 1 through 27, you start with Adam and you go all the way up to Abraham. It's in your notes. I'm not going to show you all the names. But from Adam to Abraham. And then you go from Matthew 1, 1 through 16. You can go from Abraham all the way up to Joseph, Jesus being born. There is a guy right here named Jehoiachin or Jeconiah. Jehoiachin is the one that was taken captive into Babylon in 597. He has a family. He said that his son, he'll never have a son sit on the throne, and he doesn't, because his son would be, in a sense, Jesus, but through Joseph, he's not the father. That's the virgin birth. That he does not have a son sit on the throne is a sign of the virgin birth. But he does have sons. They're recorded in the Bible. Now, the Bible records Jehoiachin from David, Jehoiachin to Zerubbabel. Some of them do come back. So we go here from David through Solomon all the way up to Jehoiachin. And then his sons are mentioned. But some of his sons end up coming back right here. This is the list of his names. It says these are the sons of Jehoiachin who were born in captivity in Babylon, in Iraq. It's going to become the Persian Empire. Some of them come back to Jerusalem in Ezra and Nehemiah. That's recorded. Some of them are back in the land at least so that Joseph can be born, so he can marry Mary and be of that line of Jehoiachin. But the ex-Ilarchs is the monarchy of another country who's been taken captive, and they've been brought in and are kept. So the ex-Ilarchs of Judah are kept in Persia, and they continue there throughout the ages. Some of them are right here. They stay there. But here, starting with this guy, 135 AD, this is the Jewish record of the ex-Ilharts. These are the heirs of the throne of David, or at least related to the family, and it continues. Right around this time period right here, well, we know 660. You got Muhammad coming in. Muhammad conquers the Arabian Peninsula, and then they march up into the Persian Empire. Now, the Persian Empire, during this time right here, now, these are the line of David from the tribe of Judah that have just, they're Persians. Well, like Esther was a Persian. She married the king of Persia, so she probably looked like her Mordecai, who wouldn't bow down to Haman. You know, he would have, you know, probably looked like a Persian, had Jewish customs and remembered Jewish things. But they're from this culture. They're in Persia. But in 660, the Muslims come in and overrun them, as we know. And so now, this family right here, Bostania, right here, Bostanai, the son of this guy right here, is the first ex-Ilarch, or the leader of the tribe of Judah from the line of David, under Muslim control. And he ends up makes a deal with them, and kind of, you know, they continue up until the Seljuk dynasty that ends up wiping them out. That's coming up here a little bit later. This name, and I've got the link right here. I may have it on your notes, more names. It just continues all the way up until they're destroyed by the Persians in 1037 AD, or they're overthrown. But this individual, notice his name right here, he's the head of the Jewish tribe of Judah, or the monarchy in Persia, now under Muslim control, and it's right around 670. And this is his family going to come up right here. And if you look now on this page right here, this is their names right here. You're going to have 1 through 9 listed right here. This is between 560 and 800 A.D., the Ben-David family in the Persian Empire. This guy right here is in Babylon in the Persian Empire, but his son marries the princess of Persia, makes a deal to, with the the Muslims so that they don't get killed. They can keep functioning there in the Jewish estate. And they continue. Here's a list of all their names coming down. Now, he marries a Persian princess, so he's part Jewish, and this guy's named after Ben David. He's still the leader of the group. But as they you can see the names, they start change. Here's a guy named Saint Gloom William the Great, William the Orange. He's going to marry. He trained with Charlemagne he was a childhood friend of Charlemagne. He trained with Charlemagne. He's got a daughter. The daughter's going to marry someone. See, the daughter's going to marry this individual named Papa de Grappefield from Italy. And this is what's taking place right here. This person right here, she's buried right here in this monastery right there. And this guy right here, Papa de Graffa Carlingian, he shows up right here in this line right here. He comes over to Italy, gets involved, and here you've got two families are going to marry together, and that is where you're going to get Pepin, his son, Charles Martel, Pippin the Short, who's the father of Charlemagne, and then Pippin, who's going to become the governor, and this guy from the Persian side where the Jews are from, he's going to marry into the family there, and they're going to continue. Now, during this time right here, this is interesting, Saint Amulf is Bishop of Metz. Metz is right here. And he is going to become a saint. He's a saint of beer. He did some miraculous, like Jesus multiplied fish and bread. He multiplied beer, apparently. And so he is the patriarch of brewing beer, or brewers. And anyway, that's right there, and that's 582. That's taking place. Remember how popular saints are going to become. There's saints in every town. And so here's, we got, this is a Carlongian warrior, or Carlingian warrior. That's what, you know, these guys are. They're from this family. But when they marry, this line right here, the Pippin family with that another way of saying this, Arnold, the Arnold family, they're going to produce the Carlingian dynasty, which starts with Charles Martel and goes through Charlemagne and ends up coming all the way over here. Here is a coin, a denarius of Charlemagne. This is Pepin di Italia. He is this guy right here. He's one of the Pepins right here. This is a 600 Frankish warrior. And the Franks are the German tribes that are all coming together. Remember, we've got the iconoclastic controversies being ended. We ended last week with Emperor Leo III having no icons. And again, the emperor is from Constantinople. The pope is going to be from Rome. They're the Western Empire and the Eastern Empire. Then, of course, remember, his wife, Irene, blinds their son, Leo, when he's 10 years old because she wanted to make sure they could bring images back. And that's kind of where we end up right here with this page. And I want you to look now on your notes, in your books. Go to right around page 2. We left off on page 288 in the year 780. And then you see on the left page right there, Leo IV and Irene. And we've talked about that. She blinds her son. She ends up losing her position and ends up working for a living. The next thing in 787, right around this time, you know, where she's just brought idol worship back, they have the Second Nicene Council, and they sanction idol worship. They make it a positive thing. Now, again, don't forget, we're going to have the Western Church and the Eastern Church. The Eastern Church is Greek-speaking, a Constantinople. The Muslims haven't gotten there yet. You've got the Western Church, which is Rome, Italy. They're making some approaches to it. They're already in Spain, but Rome speaks Latin, and it's the Western Church. This right here, They, at the Council of Nicaea, the second Council of Nicaea, they sanction idol worship. They think this is fine. Image worship. We want to say idol worship. They're not going to say idol worship. They're going to honor, and they're not going to worship images, but they're going to honor them. They're going to treat them as holy. They're going to touch them, pray to them, kiss them. They're not going to worship them like an idol, but boy, they're really, really close. In fact, during the council, an image was brought in and kissed by all the delegates. These are all the bishops there voting on church policy. They all brought in an image, not an idol, a statue or a painting, an image, not an idol, an image of something holy. And they all kissed it, but it was all kissed by all the delegates. And then they said together the theme, the motto that they wrote, "Thus we believe, this is the doctrine of the apostles. Anathema," that means cursed, "upon all who do not adhere to it, who do not salute the images, who call them idols, and who charge Christianity with idolatry." Do you see how close that is? You've got me over here. You pray to God the Father through the name of Jesus Christ. You don't bring him money. You don't manipulate him. You're obedient to his command. You may give money. You may do good deeds, but it's not to get favor. That's how you pray. But to think that you're going to come over, well, here's a picture of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Right there's the cross right over where Jesus was crucified. That's right. That's a photograph, not an image. That's an actual photograph of the place. It's as if you're almost there. Is there any power? Do you get closer? Now, again, I think mentally, you know, emotionally, your soul, you can see that and think about it and contemplate it. Think about the truth. But there's no, well, again, this is what the church is deciding. They're saying there's power, there's honor of coming over here and kissing this and bowing down to this and honoring this, because you can't get to God. You can at least get to a picture of God. And that's as close as we can come. It's like, but then doesn't the Bible say, Jesus says, "You come to the Father through me. There's no way except one." But anyway, they're going to say this, that if you're not going to use images, you're cursed. And that is how the apostles taught them. Now, what you'd like to do right now is rifle through the Bible verses in your memory and the New Testament, and where those verses where they're told to use images, crosses, kiss holy sites, you can't find. In fact, you get to Hebrews, they're even renouncing the Old Testament rituals. They're even renouncing the Passovers and the sacrifices and the priesthood, that there's a new priesthood. There's the sacrifices are finished. So anyway, that's taking place right there. Eventually, the Protestants, when they come about, and we're going to get there, eventually, the Protestants are going to disregard this council. They're going to cross it off. You know, we go through all the church councils. The Protestants are going to recognize certain councils, like the Nicene, number one, the Nicene Creed came from there. And other, from Constantinople, say, okay, we agree with this. Maybe they decided on the deity of Christ, or the persons of Christ. How many, you know, persons are there? The Trinity, they're going to agree. But on this one, the Protestant movement, when they got started, they're just like, cross it off. This was not, anytime you're saying the apostles taught us to worship images. Nonetheless, that's taking place right there. The positive side is that last bullet point, it saved Christian art. Okay? Because there are things that they created. Now, they may have been worshiping it or kissing it or using it for holiness, but at least it was preserved, and we can like look and see, you know, what they thought, how they created things. That's the positive side. Now, at this time, Charlemagne's coming up in the year 800, right here, 793, 800. Charlemagne, the divided kingdom consisted of the emperor in the east and a ruling pope in the west. Again, we've talked about that. You've got those two kingdoms. The popes claimed power in 590 and continued to increase their claims. The Arian Christians, called Lombards, attacked Rome several times. Now you've got Christians attacking Rome because of theology. The pope needed a military support and called on the Franks Now, the Franks are Germanic tribes. They come all the way across. I don't have a map. Yeah, right here. You see right here? It's on your notes, too. This whole area would be Franks right up in there. They call on the Franks to come help them. The Franks had invaded Gaul from their homeland on the Rhine River. The Gauls had adopted Roman culture from Julius Caesar's invasion many years ago. This Roman culture now passed to the Franks upon their invasion of Gaul. So now the Franks become Roman because now they've assimilated to the culture in Gaul because it was Roman. Now the Franks invade, and they're like, huh, they just became, and that's why they were open to, you know, assimilation. They didn't come in and change the culture. I'm not going to spend more time on that. Clovis, from 466 to 510, united the territory from the Rhine all the way to France. So this whole territory now has been united during this time period. Clovis accepted Christianity because his wife was a Christian. Clovis' sons were weak and just partied in the palace. And Pippin was the first mayor. And this power, he had to hand it off to someone else. So Pippin became the leader for him, and he had an illegitimate son called Charles Martel. Now, we've talked about Charles Martel. He saved right here in the Battle of Tours, right here. He drove the Muslims back. So this is all the background for that. Charles Martel was the warrior that saved Western Christianity. Martel supported Boniface's work in the evangelizing of the tribes beyond the Rhine. So they're bringing Christianity up from the Roman church. Martel's two sons reigned after him. One joined a monastery, leaving Pippin the Great to rule as king. So you can see right here, Pippin the Short or the Great was ruling as king. And the next thing that's going to take place right there, Pope Zacharias needed help against the Arian Lombards, 754 to 756. Pepin donated land in central Italy to the Pope. This would be known as the donation of Pippin, not the donation of Constantine, and the Pope, it was been the Pope's possession there until 1870. We talked last week about 755, you see, the donation of Constantine, which was a fake, where Constantine got leprosy and it was a fake document, but the popes used it to gain power. Now, in 742, Charlemagne, the next ruler of the West and king of the Franks, was Pippin the Great's son, Charlemagne. Charlemagne began to reign in his father's place in 768. Charlemagne was crowned emperor of the Romans by the Pope. So he is now, the Pope is still in charge of the church, but Charlemagne is in control of this whole area, the whole Western church area. He's in charge of it, and it's going to continue to unite. Charlemagne continued the policy of protecting the papacy or protecting the Pope and his territory and his churches. Charlemagne would influence everything in Western Europe. Everything is going to be influenced by Charlemagne. In my notes right here, I've got Charlemagne was 7 foot tall. I got that from some book when I was studying, putting this together 25 years ago. Since this time, they have found his relics, or they know where he's buried. They have his relics, and they've measured his femur, his bones of his leg. He was not 7 foot tall. This is a fact. They know because they measured his relics. He was 6 foot. And so it's just interesting because his father's name is Pippin the Short, and he's supposed to be like this 7 foot giant, but he was probably large. His dad's known as Pippin the Short, and he's 6 foot. He probably does look like a giant. And he wasn't as robust as they make his appearance to be. Nonetheless, this is Charlemagne at this time taking place. And again, here's a denarius of Charlemagne from 812 to 814. It's got his name on it and everything. That's kind of interesting. At this time, the Muslims settle in southern Italy. They defeat the Byzantine army. The Muslims sack Rome and do damage to the Vatican. The Council of Constantinople IV takes place. And this is where now we're going to have this tension between the East and the West is growing. And the reasons for this is on page 291. The reasons for the supremacy of the Western Roman Church over the Eastern Church in Constantinople. They've got the Roman Church and the Constantinople Church. They're both very powerful churches. But the donation of Constantine became a factor because Constantine supposedly had given special privilege to him, but that was a false document that was used. Collection of false decrees by earlier bishops. They were into false news. They were producing documents that were claiming certain things. The very fact that they can say a painting should be that the apostles, now listen, you know the apostles didn't tell you to honor paintings and statues of the saints. Why? Because you have a Bible. You've read the Bible. But if the only person giving you information about the Bible is someone who's using false documents trying to manipulate the crowd, that's why it says there's a collection of false decrees by earlier Roman bishops. These asserted the Roman bishop, or the Papa, you know, Papa, that's what Pope means, was supreme over all the bishops. It also claimed that the church was free from secular control. These decrees that were handed down by the apostles is the church is not under the control of any secular government. Now, if you have a Bible, if you come to Generation Word, if you were here yesterday listening to us teach this Sunday and last Sunday, it says very clearly in Titus chapter 3, the first thing is be submissive and obedient to your rulers and authorities. And they're not church officials. Now, they'll talk about church officials or church leaders, but there they're talking about the rulers of the pagan island of Crete, which he'd already quoted that the poets say they're miserable people, they're liars, they're brutes, they're evil beasts. But as far as the government, if you're going to become a Christian in that society, you still function in that society under the... Now, I know that because my Bible tells me so. But over here, they're saying, ah, no, the church is over all, and it's going to cause a lot of confusion. And again, we got to work through all that. And then the doctrine of Mass, again, the bread and the wine. And in this case right here, the priests were the only ones that could bring about the real presence of Christ. And if you got out of sync with the priest, you couldn't take communion. So because they could get you forgiven of sins, they were the absolute authorities over even the government, and Constantine and other documents had given them certain power. The Roman Church in the West, the Catholic Church, the Latin Church, gained more momentum and more power than the Greeks, and eventually the Greek Orthodox are going to say, we've had enough, and they're going to make a break for it. In 880, the Muslims lose Italy. Christians begin to reclaim Spain from, you know, coming down here. That's been growing. The Abbey of Cluny is founded, and there's going to be a time of monasteries and abbeys are being founded. We could read about that. You can take some looks at that. The Clunic leaders, here's one of the bullet points down there. The Clunic leaders, that would be the leaders of the monastery, they're calling for reform. They're saying the church is out of control. That's why they've left society. They've left the church. They've gone to a monastery, and they're condemning simony, which is the buying and selling of church offices for money. They condemned nepotism, which is the practice of showing favoritism to relatives. And we're going to see that coming up here. Celibacy. The clergy could no longer keep concubines, nor could they marry. Their attention was not to be to the church. In other words, they say, this is getting out of hand. We're going to have the pastors that you should be able to marry because you're not getting married, but you've got this collection of concubines like a bunch of Muslims here. And this is what the monks are criticizing the bishops. You can just feel the tension here. Ascetic life was restored and good schools were formed. They're going to have the beginning of the scholastic movement is coming, where they're going to really start pushing education. It's amazing how many, not amazing, but these people can't read. I mean, very few, if you're going to go to a monastery or something, you're going to be able to read. But like, you know, Charles Martel and Charlemagne, they're going to have scribes helping them read things or write things. They're not, but Charlemagne was going to be one of them that's going to start advancing education up in the territory of the Franks. Meanwhile, what's going on, you've got the Muslims coming from the south, but coming in from England, you've got the Vikings coming sweeping down into this area too. In the 800s, during this time period, we're just getting to it, the Vikings, the splendid Frankish empire of Charlemagne began to dissolve quickly after his death and was dependent on that he had built it with his own genius. The 800s, the decline of the Holy Roman Empire, some basic reasons the Holy Roman Empire is going to decline are listed here. It's the Teutonic principle. The emperor's land was divided between his sons. Well, if you're the emperor and you divide your land three ways, and then they divide their land for their sons, pretty soon you've just got a bunch of little broken up kingdoms, and now they're fighting with each other. And then the Vikings were coming from Sweden and Denmark and Norway. Norway causing problems for them. This led to the 800s age of feudalism. And again, you've had some great times in history, but right now, the decline of the city life and the trade forced people back to the farms. The public power went into the private hands of the landowners. There was were three basic groups now in these small feudal communities. You no longer have the giant empire of Rome and the Roman troops overseeing their empire. Charlemagne had done a great job, but that his was fading because he was gone and his genius was fading. He was no longer there. And so the communities, again, this is not like, you know, you need to write this down, but they're broken up into protectors, producers, and prayers. They're going to be a priestly class that's going to oversee the churches and the needs oversee. The producers, that would be the foundation, you know, the serfs that are going to take care of the farming. They're going to be producing the crops, the material, the industries. And then there's going to be the protectors, because as soon as you get some industry, as soon as you get some food, the next tribe over, like the Cretans, are going to come over and steal it. So now you've got to have someone protecting. So you need to have prayer, a spiritual life. You need to have a productive life, and you need to have a life of protection. Now, as we look at those things right there in America today, protectors, producers, and prayers, we would say that we have got a lot of producers. Prayers, I would like to see us become more spiritual and pray. But, you know, kind of what we're missing in our culture right now is the protectors. I would say, starting with the government, being able to say yes and no to things that are immoral, illegal, criminal, dangerous, barbaric, violent. We need a protecting class. But because we've been dumbed down, not because we're in the Dark Ages, not because we're in the Middle Ages, but because we're in the fourth generation of a declining culture, we have convinced ourselves that manhood is something we should not, that's toxic masculinity. Like, can you imagine all these guys that are carrying these swords, they're riding horses, they're fighting to protect their families. They would be considered very toxic, they're overloaded on testosterone. It's like, no, they're protecting their families. They're protecting their produce, because the lazy barbarians, if they're the Muslims or the Vikings or the Norsemen, are coming to take it. Well, we don't want to have conflict. I tell you where you can go if you don't want conflict. It's called slavery. And it's coming. The feudal system is going to produce that for those people that don't want to or can't protect, produce, and pray. Well, welcome to slavery. And the Muslims are going to cooperate with that also. The church became secular and concerned about land because they started gaining power of land. The people faced the choice. They had to be loyal to the temporal lord on whose land he lived. So, example, you may not own land. You know, the king would own the land, and then serfs or lords or esquire would end up having land to work with. But they got to decide who they're going to be able to be faithful to, because the church wants land. The knights, the kings want land, and now the people have to decide who are we going to cooperate with. So there's all kinds of tension. This became a breeding ground for bad doctrine, and so the church is not going to, they're not interested in teaching truth. They're interested in gaining land and building mega churches. In Germany, there was a significant division of people into small groups due to their livelihood and topography. The north, with the rivers, flowed north, and the land was a plain. The south, the rivers flowed south, and the land was mountainous. So it's just natural for them to break off into little groups, and so they're going to be able to survive. Tribal divisions and feudalism led to decentralized authority. The need for unity came when the northern Vikings invaded. Now, this leads us to Henry Fowler. You see this person? Papa, we entered right here. He came in from that Jewish line coming out of Persia. He's going to have a son who's going to have a daughter named Hedwig, and she is going to end up marrying right here. Enter right here. She's going to marry Otto the First, the illustrious. He's Duke of Saxony. We're talking again about the Frankish tribe going up into Germany. This right here, Hedwig, she's going to have a daughter named Uda von Metzger, and she is the sister of Henry the First, the Fowler. Now, when we go to this next screen, that same family is going to pop up. Henry the First, the Fowler, there he is right here, is going to be in this line. That line is going to marry over here and produce these people coming up right here. So this guy is the brother of Oda Uda right here, who's related to Hedgewitch right here, and he came in from the other slide. So here's another family going back to 670 from Germany. So here's a bunch of the King of Saxon, these guys right here. For example, this is Otto right here, the first. His daughter, Odoota, is right here. Odoota didn't join a monastery. She was joined a nunnery. She became the first abbess, which is the leader, leading female, right here at this place. Her father was Otto the First. He's going to have a son, also named Henry the Fowler, who we're going to see on the next screen, who is going to be the king of Germany. So that's what's taking place right here. During this time, we got Henry the Fowler, who is Otto the First son and sister to Oda. Henry the First, he's Henry's son, Otto the Second, the Great, is going to be king of the Germanic tribe. So yet that's Otto the Second. This is Otto the First. And then Otto the Third is going to force an election of cousin Bruno right here. And then right here in 1009, the Holy Sepulchre is going to be destroyed. Right here where the Constantine had carved a rock out of the, or had carved a monument out of the rock there. This is the only thing that's left of it right there and some other parts. But that's coming up right here. So that's where this slide is going through right here. And so we're looking right here at Henry the Fowler, a year 919, Henry the Fowler, Duke of Saxony, was made ruler of those divided Germanic tribes created by feudalism. And so after Charlemagne's time, they began to break apart. 100 years later, Henry's going to start rebuilding them. And his father, Otto, and Odoota, is going to become a nun. And then Otto the Great is Henry the Great's son, Otto the Second, right here. Otto made the dukes his vassals. Otto took over the church and began appointing bishops himself. This is going to change the game. He's going to start appointing the governor, the king, is going to start appointing the bishops over the churches that are in his territory. He's going to give out the land, and he owns the land. He's over the land. They'll work and give him a share of the crop, and then they can live peacefully, happily ever after there by the brook. Otto overreached his authority, like all men do, by becoming involved in the affairs over the Alps in Rome. He is up here. Well, I lost my map. He's up here in Germany where the Franks are, but all the power's there in Rome, so I want to go down there and have influence. So Otto, this is right here, Otto the Second, the Great, he went to Italy to help the Pope in battle and was crowned Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire in 962. So it's like a return of Charlemagne. He's got his country controlled. Now he helps the Pope out in battle because the Pope's got to have an army. He's being invaded by Muslims. He's being invaded by Lombards. So he needs help from the German, king, the German duke. He went over to Rome and helped unite all of Europe until Napoleon arrived in 1806. So he's going to set something up with the church that's going to hold together until the days of Napoleon. For the next 200 years, the Roman church had weak leaders and the German emperors crossed the Alps to help bring order to the chaos. So for the next 200 years, going up to about 1000 AD, the popes are going to be, ineffective. But the Germans, the Franks, are going to be coming over and helping them establish things. In 996, Otto III put down a faction of Roman nobles and forced the election of his cousin Bruno. Cousin Bruno, he goes in there, they win the war, but when they get over to Rome, it's like, fine, we're not going to listen to you anyhow. We're just going to take over. In fact, I've got a new pope for you. Who is it? It's cousin Bruno. Bruno, you want to be pope? I sure do. He put down his sword, took off his armor, and put on some kind of pope clothes or whatever. And they called him Pope Gregory V. So cousin Bruno, Otto III, made cousin Bruno Pope Gregory V. That's how church history's rolling right now, with the Germans controlling Italy. Meanwhile, in 1009, that's where we're at right here, 1009, we just crossed the 1,000-year mark, the Muslims have gone into Jerusalem and have now crushed the Holy Sepulchre. It's been there since 326. It's been a holy site since 30 AD. Now, 1,000 years later, if the Muslims had a choice to destroy the burial tomb of Jesus Christ, would they do it? Yes, they did 1,000 years ago. But they said, let's just trash the Holy Sepulchre. If they crushed the Holy Sepulchre 1,000 years ago, what will they do to your church? Well, it's like, it's just history. It's like, I had no input on this. My culture had no input on why the Muslims came and crushed the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The only real interaction these people have had with the Muslims is Charles Martel driving them back into Africa and get out of Europe. That, and it's like, and why they do that? Because they're on their way up, taking all of that land. And here's what you see, a map. We've seen it 1,000 times before, or at least several times. This is the division of 1054, the schism. In 1054, let me go to one more screen here. 1054, not only do we have trouble with the Muslims. Okay, now we're going to see that right here. Hugh Fitzbaldrick, okay? You see how these slides are all working together? They all go back to those, to the, that group that was in Persian Empire that were the head of the House of David. They married into the German side in France. And now we've got German, we've got France, we've got the Franks. We're going to pick up England here in just a moment. We're going to marry into this line. And here we go to the next slide. This is from 900 to about 1200. And what's on this time period right here, Henry the Fowler. And look right here. Henry, remember who Henry the Fowler was? He was Uda's brother, the son of Otto the First. And she joined a nunnery, and her dad was head of some of the, well, right here, Otto was Duke of Saxony. Well, there he is again, but now he's in line, and he's going to have a son who's going to have a daughter who's going to marry someone who's going to have a daughter, and they're going to produce this right here, and they're all going to end up, there's three families, this family from Henry the Fowler, which we've already got on one side, coming down into here, and then they're going to end up marrying these people from France, the Stuttvilles. Now, nonetheless, 900, Henry the Fowler unites the Germanic tribes. Otto the Third forces the election of cousin Bruno to be the Pope. 1009, the Muslims crush the Holy Sepulchre. Now, we're heading to the First Crusade right here. And they're going to come out of France. They're going to go over. They're going to regain Jerusalem. And they're going to build what you see right here over what the Muslims destroyed. That's a crusader structure. And, you know, it's been managed since that time. But those are, I'll show you some pictures. I don't take a lot of time. I've taken too many times showing you stuff there. But they're going to build that. But when they come back from France, what the Muslim leader did, he had the whole basilica. I've got a picture of it coming up. I've got a picture of it. You've seen it before. But what Constantine had done, they crushed it. There's just rubble over the burial bench of Christ. That whole building was just crushed. Well, what they did, they moved the rubble out and they built this structure. But what they have found in France, right here, in this case, that is a fragment of the Holy Sepulchre that was crushed, that Constantine built, that the Muslims crushed. They took it back to France, and it's been in a church. You can look that up. It's been in a church ever since. And there's other pieces that they brought in that they put into walls and different things. Some of the stones have been built into churches in France from the Holy Sepulchre because, well, just like me. Like when I went over there, here, I picked this up. I picked this up at a, I think this was a man, I can't remember. It's usually right on there, but I was going to tell you where I picked it up at. Let me grab another one here. Okay. Beth Sheen. That came from Beth Sheen. That's up in northern, that's up by the Sea of Galilee. That's the base of a jar. I picked that up and brought it back. Well, if Galen's going to do that, what do you think the Crusaders are going to do? They're going to pick stuff. I can show you some more. Don't get me started. Anyway, they picked this up. They're uncovering it. And they just started putting in their backpack, and they took some back. And that is in France right now. So part of the 109, that's a long time ago. They've got that in France yet today. All right, 1075, the Seljuk Turks, which are people from Turkey, Asia Minor, where Paul ministered, you know, Colossae, Hierapolis, they're Muslims, and now they came down and they occupied the Holy Land. They're occupying the Holy Land. Pope Gregory the Seventh, Hildebrand, is going to become Pope right here. We'll read about him. Bernard of Clairvaux is going to be important. And then 1096, the First Crusade. It's going to be successful. They're going to go over and conquer Jerusalem, take it back, drive out the Muslims, and start restoring some things. Peter Waldo in 1176 is going to be a very good individual. He's going to be a serious Christian. He is a very wealthy businessman. He's going to give his money away, take a vow of poverty, and start traveling and teach, because the church isn't doing it. He's going to start doing his own Bible studies. And he is going to, because he gets there, they don't understand. I mean, he thinks just like we would think. I think he's probably smarter, more aggressive, and better than I am. But it's like trying to communicate the Word of God to the people. The power is when the people understand the Word, not when they become Christianized and go to church and pay their money and give you their land and kiss your relics. He begins to translate the Latin Vulgate Bible into the languages of whoever. If it's the Lombards, he translates it into, if it's the Goths, if it's German, he's now in the year 1176, he's a Bible translator, because he wants to get people. Now again, he can't bind them up and print them. He's going to have to write them out himself or have scribes. Now he made one translation. We'll put it on the copy machine. We don't have one. You know, and then they bring in a bunch of scribes, and then they say, copy. And then they start copying it. And so he's translating the Bible for the people in 1176. Guess who finds out about that? Church. They're going to call him a heretic. It's coming up right here real soon. Peter Waldo and the Waldesians are going to be called lunatics, heretics, because they're not following the direction of the church. In fact, what, right here, 1179. That's 1176. By 1179, the Council of Rome, the Third Council of Rome, Waldesians, that's Waldo's followers, are tested. They're asked some questions, very, not advanced, but very liturgy, you know, and all the things the councils have passed, they ask them, I'll read it to you. And they don't ask the question with the right preposition, and the council mocks them and excommunicates them, and then they're going to have the Third Crusade. So let's get started with this slide right here. Things that are interesting here, you've got Henry, the King of Germany, Henry the Fowler. He's going to marry his daughter, is going to become the Queen of France. She's going to have a daughter who's going to marry this person, who's going to have this person who's going to be in France. Blanche is going to marry into this family, the Robert III de Stuteville. They're from England. This whole line comes from England. Coming down like this, you can see them. 992, Robert de Stuteville I. In fact, there's Robert Stuteville. There he is right there. That's his coin. That's his penny. That's a penny from Robert de Stuteville I, a silver penny. From 1137, 1153, he is the one mounted on a horse with his armor, with a long sword mounted up and ready to go. Here's Duke Herman Billing, and that is this person over in this family, Duke Herman Billing. He was the first Saxon, the House of Bulling, lieutenant of Otto I, the Holy Roman Emperor, and that's him right there. Anyway, that's these people. This is Henry Seal. Henry the Fowler, this guy, Henry the Fowler, that's actually his seal. Boom, he presses his ring into that. That's got his name. It says Heinrich Rex, which means king. Rex means king, and Henry, Heinrich, King Henry. That's what it says right there. Let's look at page 293, the East and West Schism. I should flash a map up here, but you've got one there in your book. But you can just imagine Rome. And imagine Constantinople. Constantinople is going to be the Greek Orthodox. They're going to be speaking Greek, having service in Greek. They're not so big in idols or images as the Roman church is, but they have their share. The history and cause of the schism, and that's the great division that's never been resolved, between the East and Western church. Now, we talked about the Protestant Reformation that separated the Protestants from the Catholics. The Catholics had already gone through this schism with Eastern Orthodox. So the Protestant Reformation was just, you know, the second round of the tournament. You know, that was, they'd already made it to that far in the brackets. In 330, Constantine moved the capital of the Roman Empire to Constantinople, okay? 395, Theodosius placed the administration of the East. These are the emperors giving Constantinople. Why are they moving to Constantinople? Away from the invading Lombards, the barbarians, eventually the Vikings. They're moving away. In 490, the Roman Empire fell to the West. Okay, that's when Charlemagne, the Franks, are going to come in and rescue it. The fall of the Western half of the Empire left the emperors in the East with no government leadership. because they don't have a Roman government, they don't have a Roman military, so they've got to form their own government, which is going to be based on the church and their own military, so they're going to be independent. In the East, the emperor was almost the pope. The emperor was in charge of the government, but he oversaw the church, so he's almost like a pope. In the West, in Rome, there was no government, but there was a pope. So the pope ran the church, but because he needed a military, he needed some government, he almost was an emperor. So you've got an emperor who's almost the pope. You've got a pope who's almost an emperor taking place. The Latin West spent time considering practical matters of politics and how to handle things in the West. I had little trouble formulating orthodox doctrine. In the Greek mind in the East was more interested in solving theological problems. So in the Roman church would skate, if I want to say, make it very dumbed down, very simple, an overstatement, but they would skate through the theological issues. It's like they said, that's close enough, and move on. Their language allowed it. But in the Greek, they got bogged down into the details. It's like you're spending too much time in the details. You may have heard someone teach like that and spend too much time giving you details that you don't really need. I'm thinking of some individual right now who's talking to you. But the Greeks would spend time solving theological problems along philosophical lines. So between 325 and 451, many theological problems arose in the East, but in the West, the same issues were like, that's not a problem. And so they had no trouble using grape juice or wine or whatever for communion. We're over here. They're trying to decide if they should use Merlot or Pinot Noir or what's the proper type of wine. What kind of wine did Jesus use? And it's like, just use grape juice, just, you know, colored Kool-Aid. It doesn't matter. I made that up. That's not a real issue. The cultural difference. One, celibacy differed. In the East, clergy married. Beards. The clergy in the East had to wear a beard. Language, East was Greek, West was Latin. This led to misunderstanding. So you're now talking your two theological language. It's not just, you know, Protestant or, you know, yeah, it's a Reform and Pentecostal. It's two different languages. And again, you can see, just imagine a pope. You can't imagine a pope with a beard, but you can't imagine a leader of the Greek Orthodox Church without a beard. The theological differences, Filioque conflict in 867, the Patriarch of Egypt charged Nicholas I and the church in the West with heresy because the West had a Filioque clause in the Nicene Creed. The Filioque was added to the Nicene Creed after Holy Spirit that proceeds from the Father and the Son. The Western Church since has insisted that the deity of the Holy Spirit. So such now again creating conflict for the Trinity issue. The Church in the East and the Church in the West had a history of conflict. The Easter conflict, the iconoclastic conflict. Now you know what these all are. The East destroyed or limited the powers of the monks. Pope Nicholas tried to interfere with the church appointment in the East around 850. So now the pope is trying to dictate who's going to become the next leader, and that ticked them off. And the unleavened bread conflict, this is the final blow in 1054. In 1054, Michael Cerellius, the patriarch of Constantinople, that's the pope of the East, condemned the West for using unleavened bread in the Eucharist. Pope Leo IX sent Cardinal Hubert to end the dispute. During the discussion, the difference widened between the church in Rome and the church in Constantinople. On July 16th, 1504, Cardinal Hubert excommunicated the East. Not to be outdone, the patriarch, the Greek leader, anathematized the Pope of Rome and his followers. And for the first time, universal unity was broken. If you want to put that in context, they're each shouting, death to the Greeks, death to the Pope or the Romans, to each other, and they just didn't have any missiles to launch. On December 7th, 1965, the mutual excommunication was removed. Pope Paul VI and Athenagoras, they removed the curses. They says, we're not going to put you in hell any longer, and they released each other from hell. So that was all resolved in 1965, which again, if you remember that, and I do, there was some buzzing about, uh-oh, time of the Antichrist. Look, the East and the West are coming together. It's going to be spiritual unity. It's you know, one world order. And then that didn't happen. Some differences between the Catholic in the West and the Orthodox in the East. In the Catholic Church, led by a pope, Catholic means universal. Orthodox means conforming to the accepted faith. uses Latin, uses Greek. Adam, okay, in Rome, Adam broke God's law by sinning. In the East, Adam broke God's image by sinning. See, it was a law or the image of Adam. He was made in God's image, and he broke the image. It's like you never thought about that, right? Christ in the West, Christ came to pay the penalty for sin. In the East, Christ came to restore the image of God in man. He came to restore the image of God that you'd lost, not just forgive you, but to restore you. Again, you can see how this could go. You know, it's like, well, can they both happen at the same time? Government officials are less powerful than the Pope in Rome. Government is more powerful than the church in the East. The bread of Mass is unleavened in the Catholic Church. The bread of the Eucharist is leavened. Clergy in the West may choose to wear a beard. Most do not. The clergy in the East have to have a beard. The doctrine of Immaculate Conception of Mary, the Mother of God, she has a role in the salvation of man. Okay, which one's that? Is that Rome or is that Constantinople? That's Rome. In the East, Mary is the mother of Jesus, yes. The Theolocus, the mother of God in flesh, meaning she's got an honored place because she's, you know, she gave birth to the God-man, and not the mother of God eternal, okay, which seems to be kind of logical. 1066, William the Conqueror, the King of England, the Vikings conquered England under the leadership of William the Conqueror, and they take over. In 1075, here we go, the Seljuk Turks, the Muslims, occupy the Holy Land. 1054, the 1305, the temporal powers of the Pope. Those are some great popes right there. So between 1054 and 1305, Rome is going to just take off. And it's going to continue until nationalism rises in France and England. Rome is really going to become powerful for the next 300 years. But eventually nationalism is going to set in. They're going to say, we're more interested in our nation than your church. Pope Gregory the Hildebrand, we're going to skip that because I want to get to this next part right here. Pope Urban II in 1096 launched the crusade to free the Holy Land and the holy sites from Muslim control. Now remember, the Muslims are there destroying not just the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, they're there destroying Christians, churches, they're eliminating it. They're erasing Christianity from the Middle East. And all of that was Christian at that time. They're not cooperating. They're not coming in and living together. They're there to dominate. And they see them coming. They've come up to Spain. They see them coming up on into trying to get into Asia Minor. They've attacked Rome. So Urban, the Pope, says it's time to go. Urban used the excuse of bringing military aid to the Emperor of Constantinople and to protect pilgrims who were threatened by a more violent and radical Seljuk Turks who had replaced the Arabs in Israel at that time. There was Arabs there that, and what are they? They are they Christians? Are they Jews? Are they, you know, what are they? The Muslims came in and replaced them and forced them to convert into Islam. The crusade advanced quickly from the spring of 1097, arrived in Constantinople, summer of 1097. They took Nicaea, so you're going in through the east. In 1097 at Antioch, they took Antioch in the spring. The crusader conquerors set up a feudal system as they had in Europe and built castles all along so they could continue to travel back and forth. Many crusade kingdoms were set up in the areas they had conquered. The Knights Templar came into existence at this time to protect pilgrims. The idea is so that they have access to, because if you're going to be kissing images and you're going to be honoring little statues, oh, you want to get to Jerusalem and touch a stone or kiss a stone or something. And now the Muslims, you can't go down there. If you want to get rid of your sin by visiting the Holy Sepulchre where Christ was buried or resurrected, you can't. And so people's salvation is online. Their travel is online. And so the Pope Urban II is going to get that fired up and they're going down. And then the Templars and castles are going to create a path of travel back and forth. And here's what they did. They captured Nicaea, they captured Antioch, they captured Edessa, Jerusalem, and established several Christian kingdoms. Let's go back to this one here. That's that stone. That's where they tore it down. Remember, that's the original stone of Constantine. The Muslims tore it down to this far. The Crusaders, when they take Jerusalem, they're going to build this part back up. So this is built by Crusaders on top of what the Muslims tore down on top of Constantine's of the original burial place right there. I'm just showing you these pictures. Here's the major timelines of the Crusades. We should do this quickly. We should probably wrap this up. And I'll pick up the Crusades next week. The First Crusade was a successful crusade. Jerusalem is captured in 1099 by European knights. The Second Crusade was initiated after the fall of Edessa. I'll show you where Edessa's at in a minute. It's over there just east of Antioch. It is largely a failure. Saladin, the Sultan of Egypt and Syria, recaptured Jerusalem in 1187. So that calls for the Third Crusade, where Richard the Lionhearted, that's what I was going to show you, he is going to go up. All the farther he's going to get is Joppa on the coast. He's trying to get into land to try to regain a place to visit. The Fourth Crusade. You want the Fourth Crusade. They head for Jerusalem, coming through Rome, coming out of Europe. They don't make it all the way. They got to Constantinople. It's like, you know what? These people are bad enough. Let's destroy them. So they plundered Constantinople. So the Christians from Europe going to Jerusalem to win it from the Muslims think these Christians here in Constantinople are bad enough. We'll plunder their city. Welcome to Christianity. Instead of fighting in the Holy Land. And then you're going to have, well, if you look at this list right here, the Crusades, the First, Second, Third Crusade, the Fourth Crusade, they end up trying to go to Egypt to try and get on a base of Egypt, so they come in and attack Jerusalem or Israel from Egypt. The next one is led by Nicholas, age 12. It's called the Children's Crusade because they figured out, their churches thought, you know, our problem is, you know, we're men and we're not perfect. And God honors holiness. Let's send the children, because they haven't sinned like we have. And so they sent 100,000 teens and children were sent and were killed. Now imagine sending 100,000 teens and children against the Muslims. They enslaved them and sold them, because they've got, the Muslims have a slave market. And so there you go. And just want to point out that these were coming out of Europe, were white children. Just want to throw that in as real clear. They're enslaving the white children, the Muslim. And then the fifth one right there. Here, what else we got here? We got to spend more time talking about this. Here's the First Crusade. They come up from here, met in Constantinople, go through Nicaea. See, that's the Nicene Council. Go through Asia where Paul traveled. There's Edessa. And then they came through Antioch and took Jerusalem. That's where they built many things here in Jerusalem. You can still see a lot of buildings. And these are the places they built castles so pilgrims can travel back and forth. The Muslims retook it. And then this is the front of the Church of Holy Sepulchre. This would be, after the Muslims had destroyed, this would be built with out of the remains of things by the Crusaders. That they closed this right here. This is a Muslim locking the door. There's who has the key to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre? The Roman Catholic Church? The Greeks Catholic, the Greek Orthodox. I don't trust either one of them, they say. How about the Armenian Christians? You ain't going to give it to an Armenian. They found a neutral partner. So the Muslims, for centuries, have controlled the key to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre because the Christians don't trust each other. And we were there, waited for one night until when that certain time when the sun goes down or whatever. That's a Muslim comes in. He shuts those two big doors, locks it, takes the... And the key's been with the same family for generations. It's an old, ancient key, but it locks that door right there. Welcome to Christianity. These are right inside the door. If you walked in this door right here, if you walk in this door and look on this wall, these are tombs with doors on them. And people have lost track of who and what's in there. That used to be knights and crusader kings, and there's crusader stuff all around, that swords and things that have been left there over the years. That's the Second Crusade coming down here. There's Edessa. This is the Third Crusade, and that's that guy Osman I was showing you. He dies in Acre. He dies there with fighting in that battle right there. And here's the one where they go down. They're going to go down and take Jerusalem to get to here. It's like, you know what? Let's go here. And they destroyed Constantinople instead. Then you wonder why they don't trust each other with the key. All right, I've got to go back to this right here, and I'm going to wrap this up right now. That Third Crusade, this guy right here, Osman de Stutevill, he went to Israel. He fought with King Henry, or Richard the Lionhearted, the Third Crusade. This is them on a boat approaching It's a drawing, but that's King Richard Lionhearted. Osmond is on the boat there with him, and they're fighting to get to the coast so they can go back and deliver. This is Robert Stutevill's castle right here. This is his grandfather's coin. And this is Osmond, died there in Joppa fighting. And these are now, you see that Osmond right there? And now here comes the kicker. Ready? Here's the whole punchline right here. Okay, you see this? Hugh Fitzbaldrick right here. We entered there. If we go back to here, you see this guy? Back in England, there's a Hugh Fitzbaldrick pub right there. That's right there on the same town that he lived in. And then you've got Hugh, matches up right here. He marries into the line right here. They marry into the Stutevill. Coming off of Osmond right here. Osmond. Oh, yeah, right here. Osmond. See, Lady Fitzbald, they have a son. Or she has a son named Osmond. He goes fights in Tel Aviv. These are the Stutevilles coming down. Here's all these names. We go through all these names. There's the Giffords coming all the way down there. See Ellis Coles right here. Now, remember where this line started. It started in the Persian Empire with the House of Judah marrying into the Carolingians. And there's several families coming into this right here. You see this? This is all just keeps flowing. It's all the same family. It goes all the way back to Jehoiachin, which goes back to David, which goes back to Abraham, goes back to Adam. You saw that, right? And then Ellis Coles goes here. And now we're into the 1500s. Ed Friedman right here. And this whole line right comes down to this person right here, Luella May. Wall singer, she marries in Bard, Iowa, a guy named Richard Lubin Hersham, who has a son named Orlin Edward Hersham, who's got a daughter named Marvel Ada Hersham, who has a son named Galen Weimers in 1960. is that not a? I mean, now I say, woo, ah, now comes that's cool. So I mean, yeah, I'm related to Charlemagne. I'm related to the House of David. I'm related to Henry the Fowler. But now watch. Don't be impressed. Well, first of all, that's a picture of Luella May. That's my great grandmother, Luella May, and her husband, my great grandfather. This is their son, Orlin Hersham, my grandfather. And now watch this. You and me together. Me, there's one. You have two parents. You have four grandparents. You have eight great-grandparents, great-great, you have 16, three great-greats, 10 great-great. You get down to 15 great-greats, you've got 131,000 great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great. You get down to the year 900, you end up with you're 31 times great-grandfather. There are 8,589,934,000 to, if you're going to fill your genealogy chart out and just no one, there's no inbreeding in this family. Everybody's first time family member. You get 1,000 years away from here. You're going to have 8 billion people on the earth in the year 900 or 1,000. How many were there? In 900, there was 240 million. So in other words, the difference between 240 million, and I've got that written on the notes here. I didn't put it up there. Okay, at page 10. There's the same two charts. You do the math. It's 35 times more people. You need 35 times more people on the earth to match it. So by the time you get back to 1000 AD, that's why I had Henry the Fowler on there twice. The one was his sister, and then the next time he's on there. And now I've got two articles. One is a newspaper article. It says, so you're related to Charlemagne, you and every other living European. It talks about that. And then the next page, it'd be 12, that is now showing you, the bottom one is Charlemagne's not 7 foot tall because it tells you how he measured his bones. And then AI, I looked it up and said AI do it. It is highly probable that nearly every person with European ancestry is a direct descendant of Charlemagne. So what I just did here, if you're from Europe somewhere, and who's not from Europe? I mean, there's only so many people in the world. mathematical probability, due to the relatively small population of Europe in the 9th century, the 800s, when he was around, anyone alive at that time who has the descendants today is likely an ancestor to all of modern-day Europeans. Some notable people that are related to Charlemagne, besides myself, Queen Elizabeth, King Charles, George Washington, Barack Obama, and the Roosevelts. So there you have it right there. That's interesting, I thought. And then on the very back page, this we ended up asking questions last time. Steve sent me information on the very back page. Those questions you were asking me last week that I couldn't answer, Steve answered them. And there you have it right there. So, yeah, from Steve in response to some questions discerning last week. So thank you, Steve. Also on page 15, I've got the dynasties of the Muslims. That's interesting, the dynasties of the Muslims that when they're just, and we come across that, you find that interesting. But yeah, so that's what's interesting. What I thought was interesting is once that you get into that exilic part of the people of Judah from Jehoiachin, and you can trace it back to Jehoiachin, well, now you're into the Bible, and you just go back from Jehoiachin to David, from David to Abraham, from Abraham to Adam. It's like we got right here, you got potentially from Adam up to me. It's like, but that's why I gave you those two verses at the beginning, you know, don't follow useless genealogy. Now, I'm not doing this for useless purposes. I think it's more of an interesting historical thing. I think, and we'll have to talk about that in a couple of weeks on Sunday, what Paul is talking about. But, you know, you're trying to find out, you know, who's who and who's got special powers or whatever. But no, it's just interesting that we're all, and again, what is on there was is not unique. Anybody can, I started doing that when I was like 14, 1970, early 1970s. And so, okay, I'll pray. And if you've got any questions or corrections or questions, Steve will be here a few more minutes. Hey, Father, we thank you so much for the chance to get together. We thank you for the information. We ask that we may judge our own selves, that we would look at our own hearts as we learn from church history at the mistakes or the bravery, the heroes that lived, those who sought true doctrine and sought to protect the church. We ask that we would follow in their footsteps and do the things you've called us to at this time. Again, we do thank you for Jesus Christ. We do thank you for fellowship with God the Father, the forgiveness of our sins, and having unity with God himself. We look forward to Jesus' return and pray for that to happen in our lifetimes or soon in our own needs that we do have. We ask that we would be delivered by Jesus and his presence.